Chapter 8. The Hatpin. John is quite sure that he is dead. He is at his own funeral, listening to the requiem. The explosion must have killed him after all, and now he's in his coffin, waiting to be lowered into the yellow Afghan soil. And there he will remain, mourned by no one, until his bones mingle with the dust and are blown away by the desert wind. But if he's dead, why does everything still hurt? And why is the coffin so soft? His eyes snap open. Not a coffin, but a bed, covered with a heavy satin eiderdown. He blinks up at the unfamiliar ceiling. Alive then, but still in pain. And the music hasn't stopped. Male voices raised in a chant. Latin or Greek? It thrums through the walls, mournful and slow. It must have seeped into his dream. Has it been going on all night? The chanting finally ends, only to begin again seconds later. It is this more than anything that gives him the strength and determination to get up. He has been put to bed in the third, smallest bedroom at the back of the house, and he's mortified to discover that someone has stripped him down to his underpants and vest, hanging his clothes neatly on the radiator. But then he remembers it couldn't have been messy. The events of last night come rushing back, and as hastily as he can manage, with every part of his body bruised, he dresses and hurries out of the room. He takes the stairs two at a time, moving as quickly as he can, which, given his bruises, is not very fast at all. Finally, he makes it to the ground floor and pushes open the door of the kitchen. Holmes is crouching beside the range, prodding the firebox with a long fork. The room is cozy in the glow of the gas lamps and the smouldering coals. Then he sees Missy, sitting at the table, nursing a cup of tea. "You're okay," he exclaims with relief. The last time he saw her, she was collapsed on the sofa in her uniform, but now she's wearing soft flannel pajamas and a dressing gown. John can't quite imagine Holmes tucking them both into bed like a mother hen, but then again, he is anything but predictable. He takes his place at the end of the table. "How are you feeling?" he asks, slipping effortlessly into diagnostics. "Any nausea or dizziness?" Missy shakes her head. As things turned out, John was hurt much more than her. "You're not the one who should be asking me that," she says. "But since you ask, I'm fine." She holds the cup in her hands, cradling it for its warmth. At the same time, she examines John and winces. "How about you?" she asks. "I'm all right." "You don't look it." John didn't check the mirror before he came down. He must look as bad as he feels, but he still tries to shrug manfully. "Just a few bruises." "Got it," Holmes cries and pulls out a blackened square that might at some point have been toast from the fireplace. He lays it on a plate and slides it in front of Missy, who gives him the ghost of a smile and sets about scraping off the worst of the soot. "Can you remember what happened?" John asks her. "Not much. I'd left the house on the way to work, and I didn't see or hear anything until I was grabbed from behind. The man dragged me down the alley, and I thought he just wanted my bag, but after he'd torn it free, he pulled a knife on me." "The bag was a smokescreen to make your death look like a mugging gone wrong," Holmes announces breezily. "But it was actually premeditated murder." He throws himself down into the chair at the head of the table opposite John. "Wait a minute, Holmes," John says. "You can't be sure of that. I mean, muggings aren't exactly rare in London, are they?" "Muggers tend not to leave them money." Holmes nods across the worktop where Missy's red shoulder bag is propped against the bread bin. "My guess is the people who want the house got tired of waiting. They tried to scare her, but after the burning rags through the letterbox didn't work, they decided to take her out of the picture completely. Interesting tactic, though, since the house would simply pass to the next of kin." "I don't have a next of kin," Missy says quietly. "My parents died when I was 16. "No brothers and sisters?" "None that survived. Scarlet fever." She tails off. John remembers that outbreak. His own mother died of it. "That makes it easier for them." Holmes folds his arms, self-satisfied. "In the event of your death, the house would have been put up for auction and they could simply have bought it that way.
They've clearly done their research on you.
It's so strange, Missy says wanly. She gives up on the toast, which is crumbled to charcoal lumps. I mean, I'm sentimental about this place. Finn and I were so happy here, at the beginning. But I can't imagine why anyone would want it so badly.
It is most certainly strange.
Holmes casts a critical eye over the room. Thank you for coming to my rescue, John. Missy is looking over at him with shining eyes. I'm glad to see you.
I thought you wanted me to leave.
Whatever gave you that idea? I was angry with you. Didn't know what I was saying, but I didn't want you to go permanently. She smiles. You saved my life.
Well, John begins modestly.
It was me that saved you, actually, Holmes interrupts. He was busy being beaten to death.
John grits his teeth as Missy reaches out across the table and squeezes Holmes's hand. Thank you. She turns to John. And thank you for trying.
I assume you saw me go after them, Holmes, John says stiffly. Otherwise you wouldn't have known she was in danger.
I did, Holmes says. I could hardly have missed you, huddled under that street lamp like a drowned rat.
It was lucky you came back when you did, Missy says.
It was lucky, Holmes repeats. Incidentally, I put your suitcase under your bed.
A suitcase? Missy is surprised.
And your medical kit is in the living room.
He points towards a wing-back chair, which is where the leather bag has been placed.
It seems that Dr. Watson has been kicked out of his lodgings and was intending to move in here permanently, he explains, for Missy's benefit.
I was not.
John's face flushes scarlet. I'd already decided you should stay, Missy says gently. I was already thinking of renting out the rooms. After I knew Finn wasn't coming back, I've got far too much space on my own.
But that's exactly the point,
John remarks, and he can't keep the sadness out of his voice.
Rent? I can't pay it. I haven't got a penny to my name right now.
It occurs to him that Holmes is as insolvent as he is. Missy can't possibly put them both up.
You can pay me when you get some work, Missy insists.
I'm not going to hear another word from either of you. And if it's all right, Sherlock, I really would like a piece of toast. Maybe you could make one that's edible?
Coming right up, Holmes says, spiking another piece of bread on his fork and thrusting it into the coals.
Did you report the attack to the police? John asks.
I called them when I woke up, Missy says.
And?
They took a description and said they'd look into it.
Holmes snorts. John glances at him.
What?
I'm not sure I would have too much confidence in the police, Holmes says. After all, we know 3 crimes committed in the street alone. A house set on fire, burglary gone wrong, and a murder. They haven't actually solved any of them.
Have you got any better suggestions? John asks.
Of course. I intend to start some investigative work of my own.
Where would you begin? Missy says.
I suppose we could follow the trail of blood, John suggests.
It rained overnight, Holmes says.
There might be fingerprints on the bag. He wore gloves. You're not thinking logically. This man, whoever he was, may have been just a hired thug. What we need to find out, what will lead us to the real culprits, is why they want this house so badly in the first place. It's small and shabby in a run-down area.
Holmes,
John mutters, but Missy looks as if she's trying not to smile. The electricity's unreliable, the windows rattle in the wind, and the bathroom plumbing is hopeless.
You've made your point.
So why? The other two just look at him, waiting to be told. It's possible that your ex-husband might have known more. He was, after all, the original owner.
Finn never told me anything.
Missy stops and gasps.
You don't think they could have murdered him because he refused to sell?
John leans forward, his injuries forgotten.
I thought you said he was killed by a horse.
In fact, it was Holmes who had deduced this, but Missy had acknowledged it was true.
That's what they told me, yes. One of the grooms at the stables in West Norwood telephoned me. That's where he was working.
Perhaps he'd been getting threatening letters too, John mutters.
I don't know about that. He took all his papers with him when he left. Nothing ever got sent back to me, so I suppose they must still be down there.
At that moment, black smoke starts billowing from the mouth of the range. Holmes slams the door shut. Right, breakfast's over. You two need to get dressed. We're going on a day trip.
Where to?
West Norwood. Where else?
Wait a moment, John says as Missy gets unsteadily to her feet. I'm not sure Missy is up to this.
John takes her arm and speaks quietly.
You told me that your husband left you for another woman. Was he with her when he died?
Missy nods.
Yes. Her name is Susan Tarleton, but that's all I know. I don't know if we can find her, but I'm not afraid of meeting her, John. If it hadn't have been her, it would have been someone else. And I'm well enough to make the journey. Please, don't try to stop me.
Besides which, Holmes adds, if we leave Missy here, they'll probably come back and finish the job. With a sigh of resignation, John follows Missy out of the room. Getting up the stairs is an arduous process, with his bruised limbs now stiffening up, but at least Missy seems okay, climbing swiftly ahead of him. It's when he's halfway up that he hears it. The chanting has begun again, the sound of male voices echoing through the wall.
Who are they?
He asks, slightly irritated. Missy is unconcerned.
They call themselves the Neinimian Mendicants, and they've been here longer than me.
They're no trouble, apart from the singing, and actually when you're on your own all the time, it can be quite comforting. She reaches out and touches his arm. I'm really glad I'm not going to be on my own anymore. I'll reimburse you as soon as I can.
There's no rush. It'll just be nice to have some company.
She walks into the bedroom and closes the door.
And John goes to his own room to dress.
Holmes insists on walking to Victoria Station, where they can catch a train to Norwood. After last night's rain, the day is fine, and he says he thinks better in the fresh air. John limps along beside him, trying to keep up. It annoys him that he has to take regular breaks to catch his breath, leaning heavily on lampposts and letterboxes. And just a few days ago, it was the other way around. It was Holmes who was the invalid. His powers of recuperation really are remarkable. More than that, they defy modern medicine. The smell of the railway station reaches them long before it comes in sight. A gritty mixture of smoke and grease which forms a haze in the air, as if the huge Baroque building of soot-blackened Portland stone is no more than a shimmering mirage. These days, the only trains still available to the general public in London are those that run on the last remaining plentiful fossil fuel, coal. And John's heart quickens as they pass through the arch into the station. It always takes his breath away to see a steam train, roaring and throbbing, ready to tear itself free and swoop away down the track like some huge flying dinosaur. Even Holmes smiles at the sight of the shining green beast idling at the buffers, the stokers, their faces covered in soot, leaning against her flank, sipping tea from flasks.
That's the one, he says. The 1102 from Platform 6. Let's get the tickets.
He strides off toward the ticket booth with Missy hurrying after him, purse in hand. John is about to follow when a man crashes into him, not looking where he was going. But how could he have been when his head was bent and he had one hand cupped over his eye? John examines the stranger. Portly, middle-aged, dressed in a second-hand suit.
Why don't you look where you're going?
That's what he was going to say. Instead, the words that come out are you all right?
I'm terribly sorry.
The man sounds well-educated.
I'm having trouble with my eyes. I have spectacles, but my eyesight seems to be getting worse by the day.
Is this something recent?
Yes, it started a few months ago.
May I have a look?
The man is middle-aged, in his 40s. He's kept himself in shape, but he has deep shadows under his eyes and his skin is dry and scaly. John tilts his head back into the light pouring through the panes of the roof and examines the small swelling above his eyebrow.
I don't suppose you have any other symptoms? John asks.
Holmes and Missy are both watching, and it occurs to him, with a certain amusement, that for once it is he who is playing the detective.
Any numbness, for example?
I can't feel my toes, since you ask, the man replies. I seem to be falling apart at the seams.
He laughs mirthlessly.
Have you seen a doctor?
I've seen several. They just take my money and give me some kind of pill or potion that usually tastes like sugar water.
If it is sugar water, that will be making it worse.
John steps away from him. I think you've got diabetes. The excess sugar in your blood is damaging the blood vessels in your eyes and the nerves in your feet. You need to start taking insulin. Find a reputable doctor and get a prescription. The man looks at him as if seeing him for the first time.
You seem reputable, he says. Are you a doctor? Can't you give me one?
I don't have anything with me, sorry.
What about your consulting rooms? Could I visit you there?
I don't have 221 Baker Street.
John turns. Holmes is standing right behind him.
Dr. Watson has an available appointment at 4 today. He charges £12 an hour.
Wait a minute, John begins, but before he can say more, the man is shaking his hand vigorously.
Thank you. I'd lost hope that anyone could help me.
You're welcome, Holmes says briskly. And now we must get our train. Watson, come on.
They depart in a great billow of steam, chugging out of the station cutting before the train picks up speed and the track curves south. They stop at Battersea Park and Clapham and Streatham, the terraces and tower blocks eventually giving way to open spaces, former recreational parkland now converted to allotments and grazing for livestock. Like London itself, the suburbs have also regressed to former times, but in their case, it's as if they've turned into a series of almost medieval villages. Many of the residents are farmers. This is where the horses that work in London begin their lives. Back gardens are more likely to contain goats or chickens than flowers. The streets are quiet, and the biggest excitement is the weekly market or the cattle auction. Holmes, Watson, and Missy are just about the only passengers to leave the train at West Norwood. The station is largely open to the elements. Cigarette machines have made a comeback, and there are a couple of them on the platform, along with wooden benches and a couple of tubs of wilting flowers. They emerge onto a street of old-fashioned shops selling cheese, second-hand clothes, and grimy-looking fruit and vegetables. They are some on the way to the stables and are directed along the high street, which soon gives way to something that resembles a country lane. There's even a pub and a row of thatched cottages with laundry hanging out of the windows. They come to a 5-bar gate which leads them to a muddy courtyard with stables on 3 sides and a trackway leading to the field beyond. A few sorry-looking horses have hung their heads out, watching the new arrivals with mournful, black eyes. A boy in a cap emerges from one of the stables. His head is too large for his rickety body, and the saddle he is carrying threatens to crush him. When he sees them, he stops and smiles.
You want to go riding? It's 2 quid an hour, and we cater for all ages and levels of experience. We have qualified guides and provide all the safety equipment required.
He is reciting words that have been drummed into him. He has been trained to greet all new arrivals the same way.
We're not here to go riding, Holmes assures him. This is where Finn Hudson worked, I believe.
The boy's eyes narrow.
He might have.
We're looking for his partner, a woman by the name of Susan Tarleton.
The boy is getting more suspicious by the minute. Strangers asking questions are never welcome. But it's even worse when the questions are about a man who died in unnatural circumstances.
Missy tries to put him at ease.
I'm his wife, she says. At least, I was. We're just trying to find out what happened.
The boy's eyes widen, and he takes off his cap.
You've taken your time coming here, missus, he says. I mean, it was months ago.
I know, but it's very important. I'll pay you for any information you might be able to give me.
That makes a difference.
Suddenly the stable boy is all heart.
I was so sorry about what happened to him, Mrs. Hudson, he exclaims. Old Finn was a decent enough chap, and to get killed that way, well, you'd have thought he'd have known better.
Were you here when he died? Holmes asks.
I was indeed, sir. I heard everything.
Please tell us what happened.
Well, it was simple, really. He got kicked in the head by Brandy Snap.
He points to a diminutive bay, gazing forlornly through a stable door.
She looks quite docile, Holmes remarks.
She is normally, but that changed. If you ask me, it must have been all the noise they were making. Some of the horses are sensitive to noise. They were right there in the stable and it upset her.
Who were?
Finn and his...
The boy stops abruptly, glancing at Missy.
Mistress. Missy finishes the sentence for him. I knew Finn was seeing other women. It's why we separated.
Then you know he was with Susan Tarleton from the Black Swan. The two of them were living together, except when she kicked him out and he had to sleep here. They were always on at each other.
He pauses.
I was in the next door stable the day it happened, sheltering from the rain, and I could hear them fighting.
It's as if the atmosphere around Holmes gains an electric charge.
What were they fighting about?
I can't tell you that, sir.
But she was calling him every name under the sun, saying that he was a lying toe rag and all the rest of it. Finn wasn't saying much, just that he'd made up his mind and no amount of screeching and yelling was going to change it. And then, suddenly, everything went quiet. The rain was stopping, and I was thinking of moving on when I heard this horrible crack. That's when Mrs. Tarleton started screaming. Finn had been killed, in front of her eyes. Dead before he hit the ground, that's what the doctor said.
While the boy has been talking, Holmes had wandered over to the stable and is stroking the bay mare's nose, as if coaxing it to tell its own version of events. Then he stops, and without warning, opens the stable door and walks in.
Sir, you can't go in there,
the stable boy calls out, but Holmes ignores him. For a moment there is silence, and John strains his eyes to try and penetrate the gloom. What's happening now? Holmes calls out from inside the stable. He sounds furious. His voice is louder than John has ever heard it.
Watson! Quickly, come here!
John hurries over to the stable door and peers inside. The horse takes up most of the room. There is no sign of Sherlock Holmes.
What is it?
He calls out.
Holmes, are you all right?
Holmes reappears around the other side of the horse and steps into the light. He is smiling.
Perfectly. I think we should head for the Black Swan.
Missy pays the stable boy. From the look on his face, he has received rather less than he was expecting. Holmes is already halfway across the yard. Missy looks at John, and they hurry after him. What was that all about? As always with Sherlock Holmes, John has no idea. The Black Swan was the public house that they passed on their way to the stables. It's small and neat, with black beams on white stucco, fronted with windows that have been etched and gilded with the names of the liquor on offer inside. Ales, stouts, porters, wines, and spirits. That's one thing that hasn't changed in the past decades. Pubs have remained at the heart of their communities. Most of them friendly and welcoming. After all, there's nowhere else to go. Despite what she said earlier, Missy doesn't want to be here and is nervous about meeting Susan Tarleton. This is the woman who finally took Finn away from her. She was his last love. And Missy's own love for her husband was destroyed the day the two of them met. She looks at the facade of the building disapprovingly, as if it too was somehow to blame. She's beginning to wish she had stayed at home. It's no surprise that her experiences with the other women in Finn's life were always destructive. Even Finn's mother was difficult. She died a year after Missy and Finn got together, but from the very day they met, she'd always made sure that Missy should consider herself lucky to get anywhere near her precious son. Finn was the apple of her eye, and that was half the problem. Until Missy came along, no one had ever told him no. Finn loved women. In the right way, and the wrong way. They were a necessity, a commodity, a luxury, a convenience. He used them, and he dropped them. He couldn't live without them. That's what he said, often days or hours before he told them that they would have to learn to live without him. Holmes enters the public house without even hesitating, but John and Missy linger outside the door.
You don't have to come in, John says. We can sort this out.
Missy hesitates. Even if she doesn't want to meet Susan Tarleton, she is still curious about her. What was it about her that attracted Finn to her? From what the stable boy said, it sounds as if the two of them had a fiery relationship. Perhaps that was what he always yearned for. Perhaps Finn was bored by the routine domestication of Baker Street. She makes her decision, crosses the pavement, and plunges into the dim interior of the Black Swan. It takes her eyes a few moments to get used to the darkness, to pick out the thin beams of sunlight filtering through wisps of pipe smoke.
The light makes the bottles and advertising mirrors glitter with a kind of soft, focused glamour. The walls are filled with the usual pub decorations. Horse brasses, framed pictures of dogs playing cards, nicotine-stained postcards from seaside towns, and yellowing photographs of the regulars and staff. Holmes is already standing at the bar. Missy moves forward and joins him. There is nobody else in the room. But then, a moment later, there's the sound of footsteps. A door behind the bar opens and a woman emerges. Missy's heart sinks. This has to be Susan Tarleton, and she's gorgeous. She's at least 10 years younger than her, and a good deal slimmer, too. Her bleached blonde hair is teased into Marilyn Monroe-style curls, and her full lips are scarlet red. The satin corset she's wearing must have been deliberately designed to emphasize her bosom, turning her almost into a cartoon of the traditional barmaid. Missy glances at Sherlock and realizes that he is perhaps the only man on the planet who is impervious to the woman's charms. In fact, his gaze is focused on a picture pinned up behind the bar. It shows the same woman, dressed up for a day out. To the races, perhaps. She carries a jeweled clutch bag, and there's a feathered fascinator pinned to her head. "What can I get you?" she asks with a smile. "You are Susan Tarleton?" Holmes counters without preamble. The smile falters. "Who wants to know?" "My name is Sherlock Holmes. This is my colleague John Watson." For the moment, he leaves Missy out of it. The barmaid isn't smiling anymore. "What do you want?" she demands. "I understand you lived with Finn Hudson until his death 3 months ago, is that correct?" "What's it to you?" "We have a few questions relating to the way he died. Were you aware of any threats he might have received?"
"What do you mean, threats?"
"Letters, perhaps, threatening his life?"
Susan Tarleton looks genuinely puzzled.
"What's this all about?"
When Holmes doesn't reply, she goes on.
"He never mentioned anything to me."
"He spent his last days with you. Two of you are very close. I'm sure you're as interested in finding the truth as we are. And to that end, we'd like to look through any papers, bank statements and letters that he might have left behind." Susan folds her arms.
"I don't know you lot from Adam, and I'm supposed to let you go rifling through my stuff, grabbing whatever takes your fancy."
Missy steps forward.
"My name is Missy Hudson. Finn left me for you. I have no argument with you, Susan, and I'm not blaming you for my husband's weakness. But I've been threatened. I find myself trapped in a nightmare that I don't understand. Last night someone tried to kill me. The only reason we're here is to stop it happening again."
There's a long moment of silence in which Susan examines her.
"So you're the wife?"
she says at last.
"Yes."
"You're not going to make me feel bad about what happened. Finn didn't love you anymore. I'm sorry, but that's the truth of it. He loved me, right to the end. He told me so with his dying breath."
Missy turns away, so that Susan can't see how much she's hurt her.
"You were there when he died, weren't you, Susan?" Holmes says, taking over. "You'd had an argument."
Susan looks at him, sizing him up before continuing warily.
"There's nothing unusual about couples rowing, and Finn could give as good as he got. We both of us let off a bit of steam, then Finn got back to work. He had to put a new shoe on one of the horses."
"Brandy snap.
How was I going to know it would react the way it did? Afterwards, they said it must have been the two of us shouting at each other. But it takes two to make a quarrel. Finn was crouched down and the hoof caught him in the temple. It came right out of the blue. It wasn't my fault."
Missy concentrates on her breathing, trying to avoid the unpleasant images that force themselves into her brain. Not for once of Finn's body pressed against another woman's, but of him lying on his back, his blue eyes glassy, his blood soaking into the sawdust. She swallows hard to clear the prick of tears she can feel in her eyes. John says,
"It must have been truly awful for you, Susan, and there's no way we're blaming you. We just want to try and find out why Missy's been threatened. If you could let us see the papers, we'll leave you in peace."
Susan shakes her head.
"The answer's no. I'm sorry. I've left all this stuff behind me and I don't want to go there anymore. Now get out of here, why don't you, before I call the cellarman to have you thrown out."
"Brandy Snap didn't kick Finn because of the raised voices, did he?"
Holmes has spoken. John and Missy look at him in astonishment. But for Susan Tarleton, It's something more than that. Her expression is one of shock.
What do you mean, Sherlock? Missy murmurs.
Finn arrived at the stable and went to shoe the bay Brandy Snap, Holmes explains. But Susan came after him and they argued. There was a good deal of shouting, and yet, all the while, Brandy Snap stood there like the docile, peaceable little mare she is.
How would you know? Susan says. Were you there?
She has folded her arms across her body, and her chest is rising and falling rapidly.
I know because I tested her just a moment ago.
So that's why you sounded so angry when you shouted at me from the stable, John exclaims. If the horse was alarmed by loud noises, it would have reacted.
Missy doesn't know where this is going, but she is aware of a creeping sense of dread. A story untold.
Excellent, Watson, Sherlock says. Yes, I stood right next to her and I shouted for you. She barely shuffled her feet. It would obviously take a great deal more to make that mare kick out. It was raining that day, wasn't it, Susan? And you had walked up to the stable to have it out with him? My guess is that you were wearing a fascinator, just like in that picture, were you?
Susan is standing perfectly still.
And was it fastened with a pin?
Up to that moment, Susan must have been holding her breath, because now she gives a gasping inhalation.
What are you getting at, Holmes? John says.
But Missy's eyes are fixed on Sherlock's face, the eyes burning, fixed in total concentration, like a bird of prey about to strike.
How do you know?
Susan stammers.
I found the scar when I was stroking the horse's head. It was tiny, a mere pimple in her coat, like the bite of a horsefly, but it was deep, and it must have got infected, which is why there's a faint trace of it still there all these months later. The reason the horse kicked is that you stabbed it in the neck with your hatpin.
Susan staggers backwards against the optics, making them shiver and clink. Missy's mouth goes bone dry, and she sinks down onto one of the wheelback chairs, closing her eyes to try and stop the room revolving. John is the first to break the silence.
What you're suggesting, Holmes, he begins slowly, is murder.
It's not a suggestion, it's a deduction. An accurate one, and no, not murder, I would think, but manslaughter. I very much doubt Miss Tarleton intended to kill her lover.
All the same, John continues hesitantly, a crime has been committed. I mean, shouldn't we call the police?
Please, don't.
Susan's eyes are filled with tears.
I'll hang for it. Not necessarily, Sherlock says mildly. There are mitigating circumstances. You acted on impulse without thinking through the consequences. You never meant to kill him, just teaching him a lesson. I don't think it will be necessary to go to the police or anyone else for that matter. If you will allow us access to his personal effects.
Perhaps Missy should be the one to decide, John says.
He turns to her. Finn was your husband. If you want to go to the authorities, if you want this woman to pay for what she's done, then that's up to you.
Susan is weeping silently,
and as Missy examines her, she is surprised to find that she doesn't feel a yearning for revenge, but a sense of pity. Susan was just one of the women in Finn's life. She was another. With his casual charm and his ruthless appetite, Finn damaged them all.
I don't think we need to tell the police, she says. We came here for a reason. We need to know who contacted my husband in the last weeks of his life. That's all.
She looks directly at Susan.
If you give us what we want, you need never see us again.
Exactly.
Sherlock Holmes smiles as if the four of them are suddenly best friends.
And if you don't mind doing it quickly, we have to catch a train back to London.
Visibly trembling, Susan opens the hatch in the bar for them, then leads them down the passage to a door at the end. This opens on a set of stairs that lead up to a small living room, simply furnished with a sofa, a Turkish rug, and a standard lamp. There are pictures of horses on the wall, a framed photograph of Finn and Susan on the windowsill. Another door leads out.
Wait here,
Susan says. She's broken. All the fight has gone out of her. She leaves through the second door.
Go easy on her, Missy mutters to Sherlock once the other woman has disappeared from sight. She's been living with the guilt all this time. You have no idea what Finn could do to you. You wanted him, you needed him, and it only cost you all your self-respect. Susan Tarleton is the same as me. We're both the walking wounded.
Holmes demurs.
I haven't been difficult on her, he says, considering she murdered your husband.
You said it yourself, there were mitigating circumstances.
I only said that to get what we came for. Also, I feel sorry for the horse.
A few moments later, Susan returns, carrying a cardboard box which has obviously been stored out of the sun. There's a sheen of dust over the surface, and a peeling label with a single word written in a hand that Missy instantly recognises. Personal. She places it on the table. Her face is pale.
This is what you came for, she says. These are the papers that meant most to him. He was always quite mysterious about them, like they were some sort of treasure trove or something. I've looked in there, but there was nothing that made any sense.
She folds her arms.
Will you leave me alone now?
Missy nods, but as the three of them make their way out of the room, heading back towards the bar, Susan calls out again.
Mrs. Hudson, could I speak with you one moment, alone?
John glances at her, his look advising against, but Missy has already decided.
I'll just be 1 minute, she says.
Holmes and Watson leave. The two women are left together in the room with its Turkish rug and its thoroughbreds in frames. It takes Susan a few moments to find the words, or perhaps the words were always there, and she finds it hard to express them.
I want to say I'm sorry, she says.
For killing Finn.
Of course I'm sorry about that. I never meant for it to happen, but that's not what I mean. I'm sorry for what I did to you.
Missy is about to speak, but Susan holds up her hand.
Finn came into the bar one day and I knew at once there was something special about him. He was a wonderfully good-looking man. Those eyes of his could melt your heart at 50 yards, and the way he spoke, he had a way of always saying the things you wanted to hear.
Yes, he was good at that, Missy agrees.
The strange thing is, he told me from the start that he was married. He didn't want to deceive me. When I became involved with him, I knew what I was doing, and I had a good idea what I was letting myself in for. But what I said to you earlier, Missy, may I call you that? It wasn't true. He never said a bad word about you. If you want the truth, I don't think he could help himself. He was like a wild animal chasing his prey. It was in his nature.
You still took him from me?
Do you really think he would have stayed?
Missy considers. She says nothing, but Susan is right. She'd always known that Finn would move on. She'd grabbed every day as if it might be the last.
I want to tell you what we were arguing about. In the stable, Susan says. I lied to you about that too, but I was scared when I saw you. I didn't know what you wanted.
She takes a breath.
He told me that he was leaving me. He said he'd made a mistake, that he'd lost the love of his life and that he was determined to win you back. That's why I did what I did. I wanted to hurt him, to give him something to remember me by. When I realised he was dead, I was shocked and I was terrified, but more than that, I was ashamed. I didn't just take him away from you once, Missy. I took him away twice, and I know you can never forgive me.
The tears are flowing fast now. Missy wants to embrace the other woman, but it's all been too much, and she can't bring herself to do it. She nods briefly, once. Some sort of expiation. Then she turns round and leaves the room.